Okay, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Johnson Shyama Graduate School of Public Policy. Are we okay in Saskatoon? Yep, wave if you can hear me.
Yes, we are.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Jeremy Rayner. I'm the director of the Johnson Shyama Graduate School of Public Policy at the University of Saskatchewan campus. It's great to be here today. It's great to see people at the other end as well. Before I introduce our speaker, I'm afraid I'm going to do a shameless plug for the school and our upcoming Tansley Lecture. The lecture is our highlight event of the year. You'll find out all about it on our website and the ability to order tickets online. So I urge you, please, to check that out. I'm not going to say anything more about it right now. We're here this afternoon to hear a talk by Dr. Neil Alexander on nuclear, the other clean energy that deserves to be part of the climate change conversation is the subtitle, I believe. Neil is the executive director of the Sylvia Fedoruk Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation. He has held that position since 2014. He has an engineering and material sciences background, with a PhD in metallurgy from the University of Birmingham in England. Neil has been extraordinarily helpful and supportive of the school's efforts to understand controversial policy making in areas of controversial technologies. And it's a great pleasure for me to welcome him this afternoon. Neil, thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you. So thank you all for coming. I think this is a very important subject, and I hope at the end of it you will too. I would say throughout my presentation there's a whole load of lies, damn lies and statistics in the way that many people present on this subject, and I want to stress right from the start I'm not trying to convince you of anything other than this is something worth thinking about, and you should go away and do some work of your own to understand the issue. So if you don't believe the figures I'm putting forward, go and check them, go and find out for yourself. But certainly this is a conversation I believe that we need to be having. As a member of the nuclear industry, one of the things that we find ourselves doing quite regularly nowadays is going along to presentations by people that environmentalists that used to be anti-nuclear and that have seen the light and have changed their minds and are now out talking on behalf of the nuclear industry. And they get incredibly, people like Patrick Moore, Mark Lynas are names that come to mind, and they get rewarded tremendously well for having made mistakes in the past and having realized their mistakes and be putting them right. Whereas those of us that have been saying these things for very many years don't seem to get any reward whatsoever. But there is something that I've discovered that I've been wrong about in the past and has been one of the revelations to me recently. And that is, as a physical scientist, till about 2 years ago, I thought social science was an oxymoron. And since working with Jeremy and Peter and Kathy, I've begun to realize that many of the problems that the nuclear industry has faced are not engineering problems that can be solved by bending metal in a different way, but are actually public policy issues. And so the Fedoruk Center has been very pleased. Recently, my board approved us putting $2 million aside to invest in research within JSGS to do exactly as Jeremy was talking, to understand more about how you deal with controversial issues and have a constructive discussion around them rather than much of the screaming and shouting that's gone on in the past. So very pleased to have had that revelation. I'm hoping someday I get rewarded with big bucks as well for having made mistakes in the past and got them right. I want to start my presentation in Paris. And I get to see the slides that I want to show you, but unfortunately the system isn't letting you see them. So the first challenge is technological. Any ideas? Oh, we're there. Just takes time. So here's a picture of, oh no, we still haven't got it. So anyway, I'm going to say I'd like to start the presentation in Paris. Unfortunately, I have to do it here in Regina, but Paris is going to be a key part of the presentation. Paris is a beautiful city. That's one of the reasons I'd like to start the presentation there. As an English person, I'd say that the only thing wrong with Paris is it's populated by the French. And you have to understand that I don't actually mean that. As an English person, I have a hugely ironic sense of humour, and I don't mean that at all. If Paris was populated by the English, you wouldn't be able to get a decent meal there, and there wouldn't be any point in going. But the reason I wanted to start in Paris with this beautiful picture of Paris being lit up is two reasons. One is recently they had the climate change conference there, and a big hubbub about it here in this country, a government that has very different views on climate change issues to our previous government, went across in force to talk in Paris. And the other reason I want to show this picture is those lights are lit by the French, nuclear fleet. And so as a wonderful example of where nuclear is making a contribution, France is excellent. So I'm going to talk a little bit about France and its nuclear program. It's completely out of sync with what I have here, I'm afraid. So how do I progress those ones? And I'll work from them.
Aaron has gone to seek technical support.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, I really need the slide, but anything I can do here?
She fiddled with it.
No, oh, now we've gone right ahead. This was working earlier, by the way. And okay, well that's the, I've had the slide here that I want.
Let's just try restarting.
So should we do this without the slide? There's a joke here that I'm gonna have to explain the joke so it doesn't work as well. But I have the picture of our Justin Trudeau and the heads of the provinces, the premiers of the provinces sitting on a table at Paris. And the idea was that I would show the picture of them and say, I'm going to play a video now of what they said about nuclear during the Paris conference. And then there would be silence. And then I'd say, that's what they said about nuclear at Paris conference. Believe me, it's a much better joke when you have the video. The next slide is to verify what I was saying about the lights being lit by the nuclear fleet. So it's taking some data, showing a graph of, over the years, how electricity has been generated in France. And you can see from this slide, perhaps we're just going to get them randomly, and I can talk about them as they come up. That'll be just fine. That'll be about as much structure as I put into the presentation in the first place. So here you can see that a good 90% actually of France's electricity has come from its nuclear fleet. And the consequences of that, so the next slide shows a graph of CO2 emissions that shows that nuclear has CO2 emissions, lifetime CO2 emissions, roughly on equivalent to windmills, and basically better than almost any of the other technologies, other than geothermal, if you have access to that. So the consequence of that is that, if it comes to it, France is one of the cleanest, from a point of view of greenhouse gas emissions, countries in Europe. And the irony of that is that France has largely not profiled the contribution that it has made through its electricity system in producing clean energy. And yet Germany, that is actually substantially dirtier in terms of the electricity it produces, has gone around the world telling people what a wonderful job that it does. So you can see it from that map that France is, because of its nuclear fleet, is on a scale with Sweden and Norway and Iceland in terms of the cleanliness of the electricity it produces, and way better than Germany. And if it gets to the next slide, this actually produces the CO2, tons of CO2 per capita, and shows that actually France per capita, including all of the other CO2 emissions, is about half what Germany produces. So it is a wonderful example of how nuclear technology can be used to help produce a clean electricity system. Now I'm going to talk a bit more because it's one of the things that people get confused about, and I think this is where really much better public policy issues is the difference between electricity and energy and CO2 emissions that are all related. But they are not a direct relationship. So we'll be dealing with that a little bit later. Really need the next slide as well. Okay, is it one slide behind? Is that? No, I just have to wait for a long time. So that is the slide showing the tons of CO2 per capita, and you can see here France at the top with its nuclear fleet. Recognizing, of course, that CO2 per capita includes all the other energy production to heat buildings and drive transportation, as well as such things as agriculture. So it's not going to be reflected as of very low, because it's not just electricity. And here's Germany that has made a lot of noise about its system, producing a lot more CO2 than France. So the next picture, I'm going to have to tell you the jokes as I go through. The next. Oh, here we go. Great, excellent. This is what I need. So this is the point at which I make sure that at least half of my audience is starting to pay attention. I might lose the other half. But we had, not at Paris, actually, but at Davos, at the World Economy Conference, shortly after Paris, we had the interesting spat between Leonardo DiCaprio and Justin Trudeau. And I think this is a wonderful example of how misunderstandings in energy systems occur. I'd like to say this was at Paris, and given that we're introducing Hollywood here, and Hollywood managed to turn a famous Canadian rescue of Americans from the embassy in Tehran into an American rescue, and also, curiously enough, managed to have Americans manage to capture a U-boat with the Enigma code machine on it, actually at a time before the Americans had joined the war, then I think it's reasonable to move this discussion from Davos to Paris. So Justin Trudeau's idea was, you know, Canada, you're a horrible country, you produce oil, and you should stop. Completely failing to understand that it's not the production of oil that produces CO2, it's the burning of it. And the worst consumers, the worst burners of oil to produce CO2 are people who do things like fly around the world in private jets and perhaps run large yachts on diesel engines. In other words, the problem is not Canada, it is people like Leonardo DiCaprio. And so I use that as an example of how Leonardo gets out there and is swaying the world in terms of how it should behave, and yet clearly misunderstanding the challenge that he has. So my argument here is that we need to move away from having public policy made by people whose primary job achievement is to be attractive to members of the opposite sex. And I also don't think we should let film stars do it. Good. So I wasn't trying to make a political point there. I was just trying to see who was awake. And I've still got most of you, which is really good news, despite the fact I don't have my slides. So this one, then I try and keep my slides simple, and the next one is a really simple one that makes a really simple point. So, right, I want to show the next slide when it comes up. We'll show the energy systems in Canada. It's something called a Sankey diagram, and it's produced by a group at the University of Calgary. And it allows you to understand where energy comes from and where it goes to. So it's not just about electricity, it's about all energy use in Canada. Are people going to see if I wander over? But at this end, this is where energy is produced. So this is stuff that's being dug out of the ground and used. We have the small imports of energy that come into the country. Because it's such a big country, at one end you need to import coal because you don't have access to it, and some oil, so there's a bit of a balancing act. And then over at the other end, it's how it's used, including such things as electricity production, and also it takes into account all the losses in the energy system. When you burn oil, you don't get 100% efficiency out of it. And I love this slide, and the point that it's meant to make, and is the reason I wanted to wait for it, is that energy systems are immensely complicated. And so if anybody stands up and tells you that they've got one solution that is going to meet all of the challenges within an energy system, they are lying to you. It is much, much harder than that. And, oh, that's going to be interesting. So the other thing that that slide shows, oh, we got it back, excellent. This is a test for me, clearly. Do I go on? Will Saskatoon catch up?
They may be able to hear.
Right. The other thing that it shows very clearly, these are exports of energy outside of the country. And you'll see from that that our exports of energy in the form of uranium exceed quite significantly the exports of energy in the form of oil. And I think that's something that, very few people appreciate because we see so much written about oil. And it's written about oil because there is more economic value in oil. But actually, more energy goes out of the country in the form of uranium. And that's clean energy. That is energy that is going to other to countries elsewhere in the world and is being used to produce electricity, and it is not producing greenhouse gases. And I think that's something that Canada should be celebrating. And I think that, when our team went to Paris, they should absolutely have been profiling the contribution that Canada makes to avoiding greenhouse gases elsewhere in the world, partially to offset the noise that people make about oil, but partially because it's something we should be really proud of. And I think as someone living in Saskatchewan, I think it's something Saskatchewan should be especially proud of, because all of that uranium is coming from Saskatchewan. So we might have an energy system here that does produce a lot of CO2 per head. But the contribution that we are making to the rest of the world through the things we do here is enormous, and it is being forgotten about. So let's start celebrating that. The magnitude is actually much greater than this graph shows. Because of the way you get energy out of uranium to produce electricity, and there's an awful lot more energy locked up in uranium than we actually access. So in order to produce this diagram, they've actually worked it out as the amount of electricity that is produced by the uranium. And electricity is then used at something like 95%+ efficiency. So it's being delivered to services in a very effective way. The oil and gas has to be burned in some way. Oil typically is then producing the service at something like 30% efficiency. So when those exports go out of the country, in terms of the energy use that the people get, it's about a third of that figure. So uranium arguably is producing more energy for the rest of the world than oil and gas put together. It's a very significant contribution that we seem to have lost in all the noise as people have focused on oil and gas. So I think then, in order to understand nuclear's role in the system, we need to deconstruct the problem somewhat and then kind of start building it back up. And I wanted to start with discussing whether or not greenhouse gas production is a problem, because I know there have been huge debates about that. And I'm particularly aware of it because in the last few weeks here in Saskatchewan, we have been celebrating some gorgeously beautiful weather that we would not normally expect at this time of year. 2016 is expected to be the warmest year on record. It beats the previous warmest year on record, which was 2015. And sometimes when we're enjoying the warm weather here, it's difficult for us to associate the challenges of global warming, emotionally, to tune into the challenges of global warming when we're enjoying essentially what is likely to be the benefits of it. But it's a big problem. It's a big problem because it's not just global warming, it's not just climate change. It is that we are changing the environment in ways that are leading to unpredictability and to economic and a loss of human life, as well as habitats. So things that are happening that are not just related to climate change, we're acidifying the oceans. As we increase the carbon dioxide in the air, the oceans become more acidic. Much of the life in the oceans depends upon that right balance of acidity. There are expectations among some people that shellfish will start being unable to make shells if we continue to produce CO2 in the way that we are at the moment. Sometimes shortly after that, the shells that exist on the shellfish in the ocean will start to dissolve back into the ocean. It's a very fine balance. And for the first time, there are sufficient human beings doing sufficient things within the environment to affect the oceans in that fairly dramatic way. We've also, a number of us have stopped talking about global warming, which sounds sort of fuzzy and not such a bad thing. Climate change, people really didn't tune into what that was about. But talking about the violence that can be delivered to us through our weather systems. And this should be a graph that shows the increase in violent climatic conditions that has been taking place over the last century. Sorry, that's the slide that I was last talking to, which I hadn't looked up to check because I have this wonderful display of what I want to talk about here. The next slide is the graph. I would say that it's a very powerful graph. My mother would look at it and she would blame it on the thing that she blames everything that's wrong with the modern world on, and that is the invention of the contraceptive pill. My mother also happens to believe that things were better when she was young and there was a world war on, so I question her judgment on these occasions. The graph, when you see it, is a very powerful graph, I will keep moving because, oh, there you go. So I think I'm showing very, very clearly that we are seeing weather events that are having dramatic financial consequences, is the way it's being plotted here, but also now we're seeing consequences on human life. I mean, imagine what would happen if Tornado Alley gets wider. It doesn't continue to be an alley, but starts becoming a street and then an expressway and pressing east and west and further north. The places that would then be exposed to tornadoes would be places that have not had their architecture designed to stand up to those sorts of conditions, and you start having problems. Windmills, if you put them in the wrong place, start being laid flat and not being particularly useful to you. So that's the kind of thing that is happening as a result of us continuing to build CO2 and continuing to put energy into our environment that it didn't previously have. So I'd like to convince you that there is an issue here, that is something that we need to deal with. The next slide gives you a feel for the amount of contribution that Canada is actually making to that. Ooh, it's kind of catching up with me a little bit. So Canada, over this period, during basically the development of the developing world, has contributed about 2% of the CO2 that's giving rise to climate change. So we have to be aware that the things that we are doing in terms of changing our behaviors and the way that we go about generating electricity and carrying out work aren't going to have a huge consequence on the rest of the world. Ontario went through this very expensive process of replacing all its coal-fired plants with gas plants and refurbishing its nuclear fleet so that it would have a cleaner system than it had previously. I think it took like 3 or maybe 4 coal-fired power stations out of action. China builds 2 of those a month. So in the time that it took Ontario to complete its plan, China had built like 100 coal-fired power stations. And there lies the challenge that the world really has. The next slide is of world population development, and I think you can imagine what the graph looks like. There you go. So, and this one's a very useful one because it shows the industrialized countries here on the bottom in the yellowish-orange color, and then what's happening to the populations in the developing countries. And so, over this period of time, we've given rise to the climate change that we're now experiencing. In the next few years, these people are going to want to live the same life that we lead. And so it's a massive issue. It's not an issue here in Canada. It's an issue in India. It's an issue in China. It's an issue in Brazil. And one of the things you can't say to them with any reasonableness, or actually you can't say to them because they'll rebel against it, is that you are not allowed to use fossil fuels during your first stage of development, because that is the cheapest way of doing it. And those populations are starving. If they don't have work, they don't have jobs to do, and they don't have the power to do that that work. So you can't turn around and say to those populations, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to develop, or you're not allowed to develop using fossil fuels when we've done it. We have an obligation to deliver something to them that allows them to jump that phase of development and allow them to bring their populations out of starvation, give them lifestyles like our own, but don't involve them in the consumption of fossil fuels. And that's where I would argue the real problem lies, and yet very few of the people in Paris were talking about that problem. They were talking about what they might do at home to change their electricity systems. And that isn't going to address the challenge. The next slide is we are working almost in real time at last. So here we have just confirming really the effects of those populations starting to come online and starting to live the lifestyles we do. This is world energy consumption. And in case anybody has been fooled by the people that say it's all right, we're putting up windmills and solar plants, the next slide shows expected energy consumptions in terms of the production sources. So here we see 1993, 85% coal. 2011, 83% coal. 2020, expected to be 76% coal. So we're reducing our proportion of coal. But these are proportionally sized pies. So the amount of coal that we are actually burning now is more than ever before. The amount of coal that we burn next year will be more than the amount of coal that we burn this year. It's a real challenge, and it's not a problem it's a problem that we've created here in the developed world, but it's going to get worse because of what's happening in the developing world. There is some hope. Some people may or may not believe this curve. So the next graph is meant to, the next slide is meant to show Kuznets' curve, which is a curve that kind of implies that as we develop, things change. We go through a phase of things getting worse, and I'm generalizing here, but of things getting worse, and then you get to a point of industrialization, a point of development or sophistication, and things start getting better. And it actually implies to a whole load of things. Definitely applies to populations. So if you look at populations around the world, as they develop, typically as they electrify, population growth ceases and then actually goes into decline. There's a hope that it might happen for energy systems as well, that as we develop, we can start putting more sophisticated energy systems in place. They tend to be low emitters, and so we should get a tail off of emissions as we move forward. So there's an argument there that says that the quicker we can help the developing world develop, the better off we are all going to be, because we'll have moved them over that curve quicker and we will be in a better place. There's a lot of people argue about whether that's actually going to happen, but we don't have the data yet, particularly on energy production, to prove it one way or the other, because likely none of the developed countries have really got to that level of sophistication yet. So I've used a whole load of graphs there to try and make the point. I now want to do some emotional images, which I really can't explain to you. Oh, there you go. So carbon dioxide, it is a rhinoceros that is charging towards us. And this is what Canada is presently doing about it. That's right, not very much. There you go. There's our Canadian man with a pin, who is going to take down the charging rhino by putting up a few windmills in Canada. And we don't need to worry, because we're going to be joined by lots of other developed countries that are going to do the same thing. So we're going to have an army of people with pins aimed at this charging rhino. And basically, worry, guys, because they are not going to deliver the solution to the problem. That's where, if you have that understanding, you can then start saying, okay, what do we do about our power production that might actually meet the challenges? And sorry, I was making the comments there about Canada and where it's focused. I think the other thing to understand is that in any energy system, typically about a third of it is electricity production. The rest is a mixture of transport and heating buildings and process heat that's used in industry. So electricity is already a diminishing return. So if you'd like to imagine, first of all, Canada is 2% of the problem. So if Jeremy, if you'd stand up, this is Canada's contribution to the problem, right? Not Jeremy personally, but that proportionally to the number of people in the room. So recognizing that that's where we are in the world, then if about kind of that, these people to the right there stand up, yep, there you go, that would be within Canada the amount of energy that is actually going into the electricity system, right? So we've already, that proportion of that small group is what's electricity, which is where all of the focus is presently going in terms of dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. But Canada already has one of the cleanest electricity systems in the world. So immediately we are bumping up against a challenge of already starting from a really good spot. And I think this is another thing that Canada hasn't been telling people. If you look at this, we luxuriate in 63% hydroelectricity. So Quebec, almost entirely hydro, BC, wonderful hills, wonderful lakes, lots of hydroelectricity. Our nuclear fleet producing about 15 to 16% of the electricity. Over 60% of Ontario's electricity comes from its nuclear fleet. Not the windmills that it keeps talking about. They do practically nothing. The green energy that electricity that is coming is fueling Ontario is coming from the nuclear fleet. So of that small group of people that was the small group of people, only 15% of it is actually greenhouse gas emitting electricity production. So we're really dealing with the very, very small numbers when we are just addressing the electricity system. And all of the rest of the people are being forgotten about. All of the developing world's being forgotten about. All of the process heat and transportation is being forgotten about. And I can tell you this because you watch decisions being made about electricity production, and people don't seem to have understood the point yet. So if you look at Alberta's just said, well, we're going to get off coal and we're going to burn gas. And gas is a lower emitter than coal. It produces about half as much CO2 for the same amount of electricity. But fundamentally, if you want to run an electric car, or actually any other car other than one that runs on fossil fuels, then you need a cleaner energy production system than gas. If you burn gas, make it into electricity, and then run a car on it, you may as well have run a gas-driven engine in the first place. So if you are going to address transportation, it's no good going to gas because you're not going to achieve anything. You've got to do something better than gas if you're going to move that far. I think that's one of the points that people haven't understood. Gas-produced electricity could actually be a step that slows us from getting to where we want to get to. It's an improvement on where we are now, but it could actually interfere with where we want to get to. It's going to be different in every part of the world, and I want to refer back to energy systems are incredibly complex. So I'm not saying that nobody should put up a gas station. That may make absolute sense in a particular circumstance. But anybody believes that that's the overall solution to the world's problem is kidding themselves and hasn't understood the challenge that we face. So that's the actual electricity generation. I have a slide. This is one I used to use in my speeches a while ago of where the public think electricity is generated based upon how much is written about it in the newspapers. So although 63% of it's hydro, 15% of it is nuclear, you ask a Canadian, the only thing that's ever written about is windmills, and so they likely think that that's where their electricity comes from. And that's, again, a challenge in communications to get people to understand that that's not the case, and that actually they make a relatively small contribution to the overall system. And that's backed up by the next slide, which is Canada's greenhouse gas emissions. which is trying to point out that, as I was trying to do with people standing up and down, that there are contributions from a whole load of different places. If you just look at electricity, it's not one of the major producers of carbon dioxide. We need to be looking very clearly at our transportation systems. We do need to somehow find some better way of getting oil and gas out of the ground, because we're producing a lot of CO2 in that process. This is our electricity here. Buildings, very substantive. And we need to work on agriculture as well if we're really going to deal with the problem comprehensively. Again, I find graphs difficult to understand, so I do a visual, which works very well when you can see it. Visuals are not so good when you can't see them. Okay, that just tries to say, so this is our electricity system that all the focus is on. This is where we produce CO2, which is a much broader range of systems. So with that in mind, I'm actually going to start talking about nuclear again rather than energy systems. But I do think that you can't talk the nuclear story until you understand the context and the challenge that needs to be met. And I think too often in the dialogues that have been taking place, people take out one part of the story and they address that part of the story. And because that's the context of the whole story, they think that they've delivered a solution to the problem, but they haven't. You need to understand comprehensively the entire picture to understand how nuclear contributes to the energy system. And in case you don't believe me, that's just to remind you of our energy flows, and it backs up everything I've said. So if you take our total energy system, this is primary wind, solar, and geothermal. So just imagine doubling that again, doubling that another time, doubling that, and you've still got most of your energy system that you've still got to deal with. And it's very clearly brought out by this. So I urge people to get hold of this diagram, and whenever anyone's talking energy to them, get it out and see whether what they're saying actually makes sense, because it really does reveal the true contributions. Right, so I've talked a lot. And you may or may not believe me. I don't have a huge amount of money. The person who's going to speak to you next has a huge amount of money. He's worried about the world. He has the time to dedicate to thinking about it. And so I'd like to introduce you to Bill Gates, and hopefully a video that will run. So one of Bill Gates' big investment, and he's being absolutely true to his word, and he believes something that I absolutely believe in. No one of these solutions is going to be appropriate for everyone. Everybody's in different circumstances. We need to develop a suite of solutions that include carbon capture, that include dramatically improved solar power, that include wind power, that I think include nuclear. And Bill Gates does as well, because he is heavily invested in a company called TerraPower, who are developing one of the new styles of nuclear reactor that they are hoping to bring onto the market. So Bill Gates has thought through the issues. He had no particular axe to grind. And these are the conclusions that he's coming through to, having reviewed energy systems in a fair amount of detail. So I think to back that up, I then have slides that confirm that a whole load of other people have come to the same conclusions. So you can debate whether or not they have some kind of vested interest that they're trying to prove. But people like the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change have come to the conclusion that nuclear has to be part of the equation. And just a couple of days ago, the UK posted up something to explain why it is continuing to investigate and hopes to build new nuclear power stations. And it set out a very clear set of reasons to the population of the UK, in amongst a much broader investment. So that pretty much the same time they were announcing the world's largest offshore wind farm. But to back that up, they say they need nuclear power. And their five reasons, I think, are absolutely perfect. It's the only proven continuous low power carbon, low power, the only continuous power production that's a low carbon technology. Everything else, you have to have some kind of storage system, or you have to have some balancing of other power going into the system at the time when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. Nuclear is pretty much the only thing that will deliver power. The UK has had a long dalliance with what we call the green energies, wind and solar. It's invested a huge amount of money in it, and it now understands that if it doesn't get going on its nuclear program soon, it will be browning out. At the point that you brown out, industries start saying, I can't work here, and they move somewhere else, and you have a serious economic problem. So the UK is absolutely committed to driving its nuclear program forward. Only proven continuous power, jobs. And I'm going to come to that, but these are highly paid, educated people working on these projects, and they create good, large numbers of good quality jobs. It is cost competitive, so people argue this one way or the other. New nuclear power stations are very expensive things to invest in, but they last for a very long period of time, and they produce huge quantities of power. Compared with the other technologies, they're very cost competitive. They are a challenge to build from a capital point of view in the first place, but once you have them up and running, they produce electricity at a good price. Safe, I'm going to come to safety in a minute, and achieves climate change objectives, which is really just reinforcing that first point. That it is a continuous low power technology. I think one of the other things people don't understand about nuclear power is that it has been slow to develop, and it's slow to develop because the stations were built to last for such a long period of time. So we still have early generation one reactors operating that were built in the 50s and 60s. We learned from those, and we built the Generation 2 stations not long after that. And most of those, many of those, are still operating today. Yeah, you know what? They weren't perfect. We weren't able to remove all of the challenges, and some accidents did occur in extreme conditions. I think one of the things the world is learning is that the way we presented nuclear power to people, we kind of implied that if there was ever an accident, the world would come to a crashing end. And that was inappropriate. I think we're now learning places like Fukushima, from a financial point of view, an accident of huge consequence, actually relatively small compared with the other financial damage that the tsunami did. But still, a lot of infrastructure has been lost in that accident. But in terms of the environmental consequences and the risks to human health, very, very low. In fact, the biggest risk to human health arose from people scaremongering about radioactivity and led to, they estimate, 1,600 people dying as a result of an evacuation that was entirely unnecessary. To put that in context, an old lady who I think was 92 was forced out of her house. She'd lived in that house all of her life. She took her own life because she didn't want to move. She didn't need to move in the first place. So that was a result of scaremongering. It was not a result of the accident. And the nuclear industry is taking responsibility for the accident and trying to make sure it never happens again. My plea to the scaremongers is stop causing problems. Listen to the truth, listen to the science, and allow good decisions to be made. Because with that scaremongering going on, real problems are caused. They killed 1,600 people unnecessarily. We are continuing to develop. So the next reactors that are going to be built, so the units that are being built in the UK, that are being planned to be built in the UK, are something we call Generation 3 Plus. They have intrinsic safety systems that allow you to essentially lose control of them, and the engineering, the technology will take over, and it will put it into a safe state without the risk of the type of incidents that we've seen in the past. Very clever rethinking of existing technology using engineering principles that are much better understood now than they were in the 40s and 50s when the original plants were built. It gives you considerable confidence, and that's why the UK is prepared to put on its website that it is a safe technology. Safety is a difficult thing to argue. The best statistics have been looking at deaths per megawatt hour produced, and nuclear is actually well proven to be one of the safest technologies. Coal is very, very poor because of the challenges in mining coal in the first place, all the way through to the environmental consequences of smog and issues like that. Hydro, curiously, is you wouldn't think would be particularly dangerous, but is one of the more dangerous technologies. Windmills and solar both have death rates much, much greater, well, not much greater, but significantly greater than the nuclear industry, including the incidents that you've all worried about. So if you take it on a rational basis and you argue safety, nuclear is the safest technology that you can actually invest in. But there are more changes coming. So one of the things that the Fedora Centre has been interested in is the future of the nuclear industry. And we see that as well as the big plants of the past, the new smaller plants that are being planned for the future that really take some of the engineering concepts and change them quite dramatically. So one of the companies down in the United States, NuScale Power, have re-engineered the pressurized water reactor, introducing those elements of intrinsic safety to the way that it operates, designing it on a much smaller scale, making it possible for smaller jurisdictions to purchase their units. And they are in the process of running prototypes, producing the information that would be necessary to license their plant. That's a relatively large plant, grid connectable, smaller than the existing nuclear plants, but still a large dedicated electricity producing plant. Then we have much smaller technologies, such as the next one that we'll show you. So this is a company called StarCore, who are developing a high temperature gas cooled reactor. The concept here is that you have small pellets of fuel and they are contained in a silicon carbide ball, looks like a billiard ball. And the concept is that even if you took all of the cooling away, the silicon carbide remains integral up to any temperature that it can get to before the emission of heat starts exceeding the output of heat from the fuel pellet. So in other words, you can not have any cooling to it whatsoever, and it cannot get to a temperature where the fuel breaks down. The Chinese are running a prototype of that. They had a lot of they introduced a lot of dignitaries from around the world. They showed them their new plant in operation. They gave them a few drinks, and they all stood around watching it. And then the Chinese said, about 15 minutes ago, we turned all the cooling off, and the plant's just running on its own, and everybody stayed perfectly safe. So that's the kind of concept that they're doing. I don't think that CNSC would approve that in Canada. That's the kind of thing that you can get away with in China, but probably couldn't approve here. That said, I sometimes think getting rid of a room full of dignitaries would be. Scrub that. Can we get that out of the video? So that's one of the technologies that could come. I'm using the StarCore logo. There are a number of companies working on high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. That's just an example to try and bring some reality to it. This is a molten salt reactor. So a lot of the people come to molten salt and say, we can't have a meltdown. And I say, you're already in meltdown. You run in a meltdown. Because the fuel uses its own heat to heat it up, and it keeps it in a liquid state. And the advantages of doing that is that all of the systems are designed to retain the fuel in its molten state. So when they say they can't have a meltdown, they can't have a conventional meltdown, because the fuel and everything is designed to contain that circumstance anyway. They're designed in such a way, again, like StarCore, but in a different engineering approach, that if you lost all coolant to the system itself would take over and cool itself. So you can't get to a circumstance where the containment is breached and you start losing the fuel into the environment. So again, a very clever idea. Like the high temperature gas cool reactor, it's actually been around for a while. It was actually, the molten salt reactor was designed to put in planes, and in fact flew in an American plane on a number of missions. So they never actually attached the reactor to the jet engines to run it on nuclear power, but they have flown that reactor in a state where it could operate. One of the things I'm very excited about has very great relevance to Saskatchewan, fusion. Fusion is the kind of holy grail of the nuclear industry. This is not taking heavy elements and breaking them down. This is taking light elements and ramming them together in the way that the sun operates. And it has been a long-term dream for people in the nuclear industry. There are companies like General Fusion that have now got concepts that they think they can make work that would allow small units. So you could have a fusion reactor that might run Regina. And they are working on that. They have just successfully managed to attract over $100 million in funding. They've just got another grant from the federal government to move that forward. And the reason it's relevant to Saskatchewan is twofold. One is General Fusion are based in Vancouver, so relatively close to us. But the research that they need is plasma research. So to run a fusion reactor, you create a plasma. You can create and control plasmas in a tokamak. The only tokamak in Canada is at the University of Saskatchewan. So we have high hopes that with the federal government talking about a real interest in dealing with climate change issues and a real interest in science, that they might start investing back in a fusion program that has been somewhat lost in Canada over the past few years. So big opportunity for Saskatchewan if we can move forward on that. And then there are other companies that are now looking to use not uranium as the fuel, but using thorium as the fuel. This would extend the nuclear power's ability to produce fuel well into the future, so much past the end of our uranium reserves. Thorium is one of the more common elements on the planet. If we can start using thorium in the reactors, essentially we have solved the world's energy challenge for as long as we need to be, we might worry. And one of the companies that's doing that, and again, I'm just using example companies, is a company called Thorcon Power. And they have a wonderful concept where the key reactor components are moved around in canisters, and they swap them out every 4 years so that you don't have long-time materials issues. You can guarantee the material integrity because it's not in there. It's like deciding to run your car for 4 years and then scrap it. You know, not much is going to have started going wrong over that period. So again, another exciting technology that is looking for funding, looking for the opportunity to demonstrate its value to the world. But the and historically, the nuclear industry has been focused on the large plants, which is where the most electricity is produced. But in terms of economic opportunity, most of the electricity generating plants are much, much smaller. So if you look at numbers of plants rather than the electricity they produce, then there are very many around the world. So 93% are less than 500 megawatts. Over half are below 50 megawatts electric, much smaller plants. So these small modular reactors would deliver power into those circumstances, and there are a lot of them. So let's say Canada was a world leader in one of those technologies. The export opportunities would be enormous simply through the numbers that were being delivered. And I am two slides ahead of you now. Right, so that's the statistics on that. And hopefully we'll get what I think is the real interesting thing from a public policy and a social point of view of what these small reactors could actually deliver, because they start hitting on the challenge that we started with, and that is that the world has a big problem. It is not about electricity generation in the developed world. It is about producing heat and power and transport capabilities for the developed world, and about delivering electricity and all of those options to the developing world. and I have a wonderful slide that shows the concept, which basically has what I am branding not a small modular reactor in the way the industry has, but I'm calling them community energy units to describe what they actually deliver. So we now take one of these small nuclear plants, we sent it in a community because we don't have the same challenges with regard to the potential of a break in the integrity of the containment. So it can, you can have the nuclear source close to where people are living. It can provide heat and power for industry. It can produce electricity. It can do things like desalinate water to allow the community to have fresh water. And I've added this one into somebody else's slide because I think this is where it really kicks in for some of the increased value for our northern communities would be you could take heat off and heat and light greenhouses that wouldn't just give them electricity, it would give them fresh vegetables 365 days of the year. And so they can really transform a community. They can take what used to be just a community that's struggling, might have to be flying in diesel, the electricity is fairly dirty from a CO2 production point of view. Now we give them plenty of energy, they can use it in a whole variety of ways, and you can transform the community. And we could do that in our northern communities, but it would also be a very suitable way to deliver that solution to the developing world of giving them the ability to move to our style of life without having to go through the transition of fossil fuels. And if you don't believe me in terms of transforming communities, there is one close to, we've talked about France at the beginning, there is one much closer to home. Ontario would be a poor agricultural province were it not for its nuclear fleet. So you can look to Pickering, Darlington and the Bruce Power electricity generation, 60% of the electricity generation in the province. That is what gave them the ability to make cars. That is what gave them an aerospace industry. That is what gave them a pharmaceutical industry. Without that cheap, available, reliable power, those industries would have gone elsewhere and Ontario would be a poor farming province. And so that's a perfect example of where large-scale electric plants have really transformed a region. So my conclusion is nuclear should be part of the discussion. It allows us to actually hit on a number of key policy issues for our government. And I've summarized it as four wins. So we can actually really do something that makes a difference to the climate change debate. Not by just playing around with that tiny contribution that we make in our electricity system here in our country, but to deliver something to the rest of the world that would allow them to solve their problem. It would be a real contribution to developing nations, that if we can develop a plant that's suitable for them, we can allow them to make that transition and give them something really valuable, rather than just aid, give them a solution to the fundamental problem that they're trying to deal with. We would, back home, develop a new knowledge economy, an economy built around people that are well-educated and well-paid. If we are then exporting those plants around the world, we would continue to gain the benefit from them while that export opportunity exists. And as the fourth whammy, we'd actually increase the sales of uranium around the world, which would increase its value and would make Saskatchewan wealthier. So I think there's four really good wins there for Canada if we can restore our leadership power in the nuclear industry. I want to finish. I want to finish. But before I do, I've seen the other slide. A lot of people have the impression that nuclear is unpopular because there are a few people that will get up there and make a noise, much of it misinformed. And so the debate sounds as though it's being led by people that are against nuclear. This is a survey we did of opinion in Saskatchewan, and you'll see that the vast majority of people are actually reasonably positive about nuclear power, certainly able to open their minds and consider it as one of the opportunities. There are a small group of people that are less who are not supportive, but a smaller group, but are not firm in their opinion one way or the other. And then there's a very, very tiny group of people that have historically made a lot of noise and have given rise to, I think, public policy decisions within the province that were probably not supported by the population of the province. And I would argue that that is not democracy in action, and that somehow we need to understand how we engage the majority of the people and make sure that they have their opportunity to make their thoughts on the subject known. Finally, some self-focused promotion here. I'm talking again in an environment that I'm much more comfortable with next week here at Bushwhackers, so you can come and listen. It is a completely different presentation. It is about how the nuclear industry has likely contributed to its own challenges by communicating badly about its own subject. I hope it'll be entertaining, but certainly you'll be able to have a beer in your hand. And then I want to finish. I was trying to put up the advert there, but I'm going to finish on that energy system because, you'll see those adverts going up shortly. You'll gather from the title it's not as serious as the one that I presented this afternoon. It's, well, if you can read quickly. I can't remember quite what it's called, but I think it's Banning Bananas from the Great Lakes and Other Great Ideas. And so that is one of the ideas I've had, and I'm going to explain why I think it would be a good idea to ban bananas from the Great Lakes. Come along and find out why. But I am going to finish on this slide, because if you haven't heard anything else this afternoon, if you haven't heard the Four Winds for Canada, or you don't believe the Four Winds for Canada, if you hadn't heard anything else, go away with the understanding that energy systems are immensely complicated, and if anybody is bringing to you a simple solution that they say is going to solve all the problems, that they are lying to you. So thank you very much.